Yo, what is a cipher?
That's what drew me to sampling.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 105, a talk with RJD2. RJD2 began his career as a DJ in the mid-1990s local rap scene in Columbus, Ohio, with the group MHZ. But it wasn't until his 2002 solo album, Dead Ringer, that he really started making noise. That album got a ton of attention for its creative, sample-based approach to instrumental hip-hop, and RJ became an important part of the LP-led Def Jux label, which was a huge force in the underground rap scene of the era. Along the way, he produced tracks for A$AP Rock, Mos Def, Massive Attack, MERS, and even MF Doom. RJ continued experimenting, doing duo albums with rappers Blueprint and AC Alone. He even added his own vocals to his third album, The Third Hand, a move that garnered intense critical backlash, something we talk about in our conversation. One of RJ's tracks with AC Alone, A Beautiful Mind, is best known to most people as the theme for AMC's hit show Mad Men, now in its final season. His new album with rapper Sugartongue Slim, STS times RJD2, is out tomorrow, May 5th. We talked to RJ via Skype from his home in Philadelphia. If you like The Cipher and want to see it continue, visit patreon.com/thecyphershow and make a donation. We even have special rewards and experiences for our donors. Find us on iTunes. From there, you can rate, review, and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. The more 5-star ratings we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests. And now, Sally Draper's favorite DJ, RJD2.
You cut your teeth and the rap scene back in Columbus and kind of like the late 90s and early aughts. What was that scene like? You know, when I was in Columbus during that period, it was only ever kind of at the indie rock scene playing in like Bernie's or whatever. So I was curious what the rap scene was like.
Hold on a minute. So you have history with Columbus, Ohio, I take it?
I've toured through there with like an indie rock band a couple times.
Well, that's a trip. It's funny that you bring up Bernie's because Bernie's had a hip-hop night, and you know, it's a bit of an aside, that was kind of a very important epic in Columbus. I know it sounds silly to say, talk about the history of Columbus, of hip-hop in Columbus, because it's such a small thing, but you know, for the people that live there, it did have different eras, and you know, people were making records going back to 88 in terms of rap music in Columbus. But anyway, so we're talking about the mid to late 90s. It was just a completely different landscape, both socially and musically. It's apt that you brought up indie rock, because Columbus has a pretty deep garage rock, indie rock, you know, as a town, it's got a pedigree, but not really as... And Ohio as a state has produced a huge amount of soul and funk and R&B music going back to the 60s, possibly before. But Columbus was never really known for much more than the sort of garage rock, indie rock, three chord bands or whatever. So the people that were involved in that scene, the hip hop scene of that time, they kind of, I'd say we pretty much everybody knew, at a minimum knew who each other was, because it wasn't very big. And it was just different than it was now in that it was, I mean, it was a very competitive scene. And that was the allure for me, was that it was a thing that where the respect of your peers was the number one thing to be won. You know, there was no, you know, passes given for good effort or anything like that. It was, cutthroat might be overstating it, but it was a scene built on competition, like most hip hop, localized hip hop scenes were.
Yeah. And so the fact that it was so small, was that sort of one of the factors in it being so intense and competitive?
I don't think so. I think that it was just a thing that was kind of what was baked right into the nature of the music. You know, at that point in time, if you listened to rap music, the competitive nature of it was inescapable. You could almost make the argument that it was the dominant aesthetic feature of the music. I mean, everything about it, you know, all the producers were trying to do, and I'm talking about on a national level, like the recorded music, you know what I mean? You can't name a rap group that put out a nationally distributed record in 1994 that was not in some way trying to outdo their predecessors.
Sure.
And their peers, you know, so it was just right in there with the type of, that's just what the music was. So I don't think of it as a thing that was a byproduct of Ohio or Columbus or anything like that. I think it was a thing where, this is what, at that time, New York was the dominant force in rap music. And, you know, most cities that I experienced, they were basically following suit, and that they were like, okay, this is how you do it. We're going to try to do our own thing. And it wasn't until much later until different regions got respect on a national level that kind of broke down.
Was there anyone from that scene who, you know, never quite broke nationally, but who was the guy out there?
Yeah, I mean, there was a dude named, he called himself The Intellect, and he was this dude, Derek.
The artist RJ is referring to here is Derek Baldwin, the influential Columbus rapper and producer known as The Intellect, that's Intalec. When interviewed about the Columbus scene, he remembered that it reached back at least to the late 70s, when his older brother DJed hip-hop parties in the apartment upstairs.
He was kind of like the generation before my generation. You know, there was a guy of my world, which is basically the Megahertz guys. On a mission, mad dysfunction. I'm kicking fronts and won't be on to something. I wreck a set. Guess that's what I do best. Releasing stress as I reflect my blackness. That group came out of my generation of Columbus hip hop or whatever. He was kind of the mentor, the dude that came before our generation. And he was a talented dude, but he had an even more uphill battle in that he was really one of the first guys that was going to clubs. I mean, there was a club called Little Brothers on North High Street that you might have passed through or were possibly aware of at that time. Because up until it closed, that was like the place for, if you're going to play on High Street, that was probably the premier place. You know, Nirvana played there when they were toured on the Bleach record. Firehose would play. Those types of bands would, that's what the kind of music was that was at Little Brothers. And he was one of the first guys to go into that scene and book shows and just say, screw it, I'm going to do what I can to get some shows and see what happens. So he was fighting an even more uphill battle than we were. There was a group called Spirit that never really broke. My memory is shot at this point.
that's fine. And then, like, obviously you'd hook up with the MHD guys and
yeah,
some of the other folks there. But you actually ended up in San Francisco for a bit, right?
I did, yeah. I took a little bit of a detour out. I lived there for about a year. I just kind of found myself there. You know, I was fumbling and stumbling around through a bunch of life decisions or whatever. I was, you know, between trying to have a job or trying to make it, you know, through music or whatever, and, you know, living out there. I lived in the Bay for a while and then San Francisco for a while. You know, and that was kind of like an important little detour that I made, because at that time, there was this DJ crew called the Invisible Scratch Pickles. So to back up a little bit more, you know, in Columbus, it was very rap dominated. The dynamic between people like me and rappers was one in which there really wasn't any outlet for a beat maker type dude other than making rap music. That was it. You know what I mean? There was no such thing as Moax or Ninja Tune or Ohm or Skint or any of that first wave of labels that really took the ball of quote-unquote instrumental hip-hop, you know, type music and ran with it. So when I went out to the Bay and I saw these Scratch Pickles dudes, that was a big deal. It really opened my mind. And Q-Bert particularly.
For more information about Q-Bert, the Invisible Scratch Pickles, and the entire scene in San Francisco that they come from, check out Cypher episode 103 with Oliver Wang.
That was a life-changing experience. And for what might sound like a fairly depressing reason, but seeing him made me realize I had no future as a DJ. I was never going to cut it. And right then and there, I was like, I got to do something else. Because for a while there, when I started, I was like, oh, maybe I'll just practice a bunch of hours a day and then be a DJ. You know what I mean? I'll be a scratch-oriented DJ, you know, because that's what I was into. And seeing him, I was like, oh, there's no way. It'll never happen. And that was a really important formative moment because it made me realize, you know, and that kind of pushed me. It was one more argument for getting a sampler and trying to make beats and, you know, getting away from just being only a DJ.
While you were in SF, you hooked up with the Graffiti Crew, right? You were kind of their unofficial DJ or whatever for a bit.
Yeah, something like that. There was this crew called the A-Team, and I would, like, hang out with them, and, you know, I was the, whatever, token DJ hanging out with Graffiti Kids. And at that time in the Bay, the graffiti scene there was amazing. It was, like, that was another thing that really opened my eyes. I can't say it directly impacted what I do, but it did kind of build up the lore of the Bay Area at that time. I mean, there was this dude, Twist, and that was his graffiti. That's what he wrote. His name's Barry, and he went on to have like a very successful career in the fine art world. But he would just do these incredibly intricate things. But it was street art, you know. It was graffiti. It was spray can art. But he had these techniques that were just, you know, so far beyond anything I had seen. And it was a really, you know, artsy, highly developed scene at that time.
And what period was this? Like around when?
This was 95, 96. I'm pretty sure that I was in Ohio in 97. So sometime around the end of 96 or the early beginning of 97, I moved back to Ohio to try to graduate from college because I was just picking up little, you know, gigs here and there in the Bay, but nothing that would make me any money. And it just wasn't happening. And, you know, and at the same, it also was like, well, the Scratch Pickle dudes are here. Like, what am I doing? You know,
yeah, that's pretty serious competition. So I was reading, you know, some stuff, some interviews with you, and it seems like there was this period where you decided, okay, I'm going to make a go, you know, in music, you know, doing any number of things. And you said there was like a several year period where you literally didn't turn down any paying gigs. You were like, well, if I'm going to do this, that's part of the deal. I have to like take everything until I can't anymore. And so I was curious about that period. Like, what were, you know, one or two of the more bizarre gigs that you ended up taking kind of following that rule you set for yourself?
That rule lasted up until, I want to say, probably around 2003 or four.
Wow.
That was like maybe 2000 till somewhere around there. I was probably turning something down maybe around 2003, but I distinctly remember that was the mission statement. I just felt like it would be foolish to, you know, especially once the ball started rolling and there was inertia. So I was getting more and more gigs. That was the point. I was like, well, I don't want to put the, you know, you don't want to turn the heat down on this now. That would be foolish.
Right.
I don't remember any particularly, man, I don't know. I'm sure that there are. I'm trying to think. There was a couple times where I got linked up with this like rave crew. I would be like the token hip hop scratch DJ dude on these rave bills in the late 90s, maybe like 98, 99, 2000, around there. And a lot of them were in Cleveland. So I would drive up to Cleveland, and I remember sleeping in, I had a 96 Corolla, and I would sleep in that car on the side of 71 because I would, you know, I'd be making like $100 or something. You know, it's like, get a hotel, then there's, what's the point, you know?
Yeah.
You're not making any money. You know, that's the first bizarre moment that my memory recalls.
And obviously, you know, the first sort of full length that people know from you is Dead Ringer. Was entirely sampled. And one of the interesting things about your approach to sampling is you're not like, oh, I'm going to get a break that like is great on its own. Like you're much more concerned with the tonality of the stuff you're sampling more than the content of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what drew me to sampling for sure. And I should mention another part of that is also that there's also a practical reason behind that too, which is that by the time that I started getting serious about making that kind of music, all of the really obvious loops, those were shot. Those have been used ad nauseum.
Right, you're not going to use synthetic substitution again or something.
Exactly. That's a perfect example, is that, in fact, not only that, but anything that sounds remotely like substitution that's in 4-4 and it's got a groove to it that's like in the pocket, that has already been used. All the obscure ones have also already been used. So at that point, that's when I realized, is like, oh, well, all I need is the sound of the, of, you know, for, to use drums as an example. I need the tone of the drums to be where I want them to be, but I don't need the groove to be, because I can just take it apart and make the rhythm exactly what I want it, you know. So that's where kind of I saw a lane. So a lot of the breaks that, you know, drum breaks, for example, that I was using on that record were, you know, either modified or you know, I would change the swing in them, or sometimes they would even mean just taking them completely apart and reprogramming note by note because they were in, like, you know, waltz time or whatever, something.
I think your arrangement abilities are definitely something that, you know, you've rightfully taken pride in over the years. I just heard, you know, the show you did with Song Exploder where you talked about this idea of sonic Tetris, right? When you're arranging, you kind of view blocks of sound as things to be, you know, sculpted and shaped and put together.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Again, I see it as the seedling that was born from comes back to a, you know, a similar idea to what I was just talking about with it was just born of necessity. I realized that right when I was starting to move from just making a rap beat to also figuring out how to take a rap beat that wasn't going to get used by a rapper and turn it into an instrumental song.
Yeah.
A big part of that was that I realized that I couldn't, my idols, the guys that of that era, you know, the Prince Paul, Large Professor, Premier, Pete Rock, those guys, they could make a one bar or a two bar or a four bar loop that was so good that you could listen to it for 3 minutes and not get bored.
Right.
And I couldn't do that. I wasn't as good as, I didn't have the ear that those guys had for that. Because of that, my angle that I came up with was I'll take, this is, I know I'm slightly debasing myself saying this, but it really kind of is true. My approach was, I'll take five of my average caliber beats, cram them into one song, and maybe that'll be as good as one incredible Pete Rock style beat, if that makes sense. So that was the whole, my whole angle was like, oh, well, this can be done. You know, if you do it right, I can get everything in key and in time, you know, and then if that's all you do, then you're just looking at what feels like a 3.5 minute mixtape. But then if you take it a step further and you work on the transitions and stuff and you really start thinking of it like you're writing a song and not just jamming five beats into a 3.5 minute time frame, then you can take it a step further. And once I realized it could be done, that was kind of my lane that I, you know.
Yeah. And I feel like in some ways that reached an apex on Colossus, right? There was stuff on there that was, you know, didn't sound super complex, but was, and I think ultimately, like, I wanted to delve in for a second into A Sun Cycle, which is the song that has three separate sections, three rappers.
Good morning. They say I'm over the hill, but get real, cause I ain't even 24 yet. It's a new day, bringing the heat to your doorstep.
I was shining, riding high for what it's worth. The words of my mouth were like sunlight to warm the earth. The world witnessed my rise, so it was hard to hide the brilliance that I projected from those piercing eyes.
It was all good just a blink ago, so I need to know how can one cease to glow. I once reached the glow when sun speak and show. Now they think sun weak, so they treat me cold. Feels like I have no choice, so I sink below and fade to black like peace I'm ghost. I laid my tracks and brought heat to folks. A state the fact you see from the east I rose. Then I broke from,
and then at the end of the song the various sections kind of like come together, almost, you know, almost like you know, the first theme comes back while the third one is playing.
I couldn't believe it. Just like that. Everything was gone.
it's all over.
It's gone.
I was hoping you could go into the creation of that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so glad to hear you identify that, because not a lot of people really got it, you know. It makes it feel like, and that's fine. If you just end up with a song that people like to listen to, that's great. I'm perfectly happy with that. But it's good to know that, you know, some of the sort of Easter eggs, if you will, that get put in songs, at least you're not totally wasting your time. Yeah, the vision of that song came about when I had, you know, I assembled the lineup for that song, and then I was like, I was thinking about Posse Cuts and how, like, the first couple Gangsta records, they'd always have, like, Posse Cut. And it would be a few of those were things where, like, the beats would be totally different. They didn't have anything to do with each other. And it was really cool. You'd have, like, a 16-bar verse that was just over beat A, and then the track would stop. And then there'd be, like, a little noise and some intro, and then it'd go to, you know, whatever, Lil Dap's verse or whatever, something. And it was always like this, you know, real cut and dry thing, like it stops and then it starts. And so I had this vision of like, what if you could do it in a manner that was the complete opposite in relation to in regards to the transitions? So it literally feel like on the radio when two songs, when a radio DJ overlaps the outro and the intro of two songs, was the vision. But I was like, well, if you're going to do this, then you have to keep everything in the same, you know, in key and on time. And that's when I got the idea of, what if the MCs at those transition points were saying the exact same thing, and one faded out while the other faded in?
I'm no longer the same, just 93 million miles ahead of the game. I know you're sleeping if you don't feel me. Gotta be sleeping if you don't feel me. East Coast to worldwide, all sleeping if they don't feel me. I know you're sleeping if you don't feel me. You see, it was all good just a blink ago. So I need to know, how can one cease to glow? I once reached the glow.
So instead of, it would be ideally it would be so seamless that you would only notice it once it was done, you know?
Yeah,
that was kind of the vision for the song, just because I felt like it hadn't been, nobody had really explored that idea in rap.
Yeah, I mean, that was, it's a great, great tune. And like you said, sort of the subtleties of it reveal themselves, you know, sort of slowly. Another song I wanted to ask about real quick was The Glow, because you said it was inspired by your time around sort of old money.
Got the glow.
I was curious about that.
Yeah, I feel bad talking about this because in hindsight, it's, you know, there's a fine line between writing about an idea and, you know, triangulating that idea against any possible ways that it could be seen as condemning or insulting. And that's, I don't want to do that with my music, you know. So it's I guess in a weird way, I hope that, you know, I realize that we're all, you know, we're all victims of our own circumstance at the end of the day. So I know that people that grew up in that environment, not, you know, I didn't want it to be damning, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I hope it isn't damning. But yeah, at the core of it was just, I thought it was an interesting thing that I got a scholarship after my parents split up. I got a scholarship to go to this private school because my mom was a public school teacher, and she was working in the middle schools, the Columbus Public Middle Schools at the time. And she was like, this is where we lived, our local school, it was not good. She had been there. She knew because she worked in the system. And she was like, I don't want you going there. You're not going to get a good education. So they basically worked and hustled to get me a scholarship to this private school. So I was bussed out to the burbs to this private school, and I got an awesome education. It was really great experience. But I did, that was this time when I spent a lot of, you know, I spent a whole bunch of time around, like you said, old money, young kids, you know, middle school and then later high school aged kids. But I just thought it was bizarre that after a while I could kind of, this might sound silly, but I felt like I could read on somebody's complexion. It was almost like they breathed different air or something. Like, and that was where the idea is. It felt like they literally have this glow that people in, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but basically my read was like the people in my neighborhood, the people in my socioeconomic bracket or whatever, their faces don't look the same. And I just thought it was weird. You know, it was this thing that was, it never really still doesn't make sense. And maybe that's, you know, hopefully I'm not showing like a prejudice or anything, but it really is a thing where like I can, sometimes I don't know. It's like is this making any sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely.
I don't mean it as is condemning or damning, or it's not a judgment in any way. I think it's a peculiarity.
Right. More just an observation. Yeah.
Yeah. And oftentimes for me, that's where songs come from, is like if there's a peculiarity or an observation or something that I might not quite even be able to understand or explain, that often those ideas oftentimes stick in my head as like the kernel for a song.
Yeah. And speaking of sticking in your head, you have like dozens of song titles, album titles and stuff like floating around your head at any given time, right? Like where do they all come from?
Man, you hear something silly, or not even silly, just, you know, I don't know, when I hear an idea and it sounds slick, I put it in my notes. My memory is so worthless now. So I used to be able to remember these things. Now I have to write them down. So yeah, chord changes, you know, if I'm noodling around on keyboards or something and stumble across a chord change, I have to write that down. So I have a bunch of post-it notes that are kind of all over the place that are just chord changes or ideas for riffs or something like that. Yeah, and I'll do the same thing for a song, you know, really just phrases or song titles or something like that. I'll, you know, if I stumble across something interesting, I'll put it in the notes section of my phone, and it'll often become the idea for a song or like that little kernel.
Yeah, well, it's funny you say chord changes. That actually brings me to your new record, the STS times RJD2 that you have with Sugar Tongue Slim, which is great. And like, there's a couple things I want to talk about it. But hold on, here it go. You have these very cool chord changes during the kind of breakdown, the drumless section of the tune.
The verse?
Yeah.
Never had a lot and still we made it work, man. Right. Now we on the road like dollar cabin church vans. Write about experiences from the first hand. To judge a book by appearance might be the worst plan. Right. My mama raised me well, therefore I'm a blessed man. My mama told me give them hell, don't be a yes man. Yes ma'am, that I do. I got them shook like Bigfoots and Rougarous. I get
thanks,
yeah. I read somewhere you got into using sort of unusual chord progressions in your music once you moved away just from using samples all the time. How did that happen?
That passage that you bring up is a perfect example of why I couldn't creatively be shackled by using samples. Solely is the only way to make music. That chord change, every 8 bars, it resolves in a manner that only happens on that 8th bar. So on the 4th bar and the 8th bar resolve the chord change differently.
Here's where each of the bars are, so you can hear how the chords resolve.
We're trying to make it in America, respect that.
One.
That I too sing America, Langston Hughes that.
Two.
I'm from the South with the Bible belts and blues at.
Three.
Out in Atlantic City where the house of blues at.
Four.
If life is a gamble, this where you lose at.
Five.
Hold on to these words, nigga, don't lose that.
Six.
You feel that fire in your gut, you got to use that.
Seven.
Don't just be sitting on your butt, you got to move
Eight.
That.
Moving.
They said that I'm the one, I got to prove that.
And that's the kind of thing that you can't do using, you know, if you're just pulling samples off of records, you're locked into whatever that source material.
Sure, a phrase isn't going to end differently when you sample it.
By the time that I was hit that wall, I was having to, it got really, this was a thing that I was wanting to be able to execute in a song. And just because I was stuck only using a sampler, I would like, I'd find, you know, maybe like three chord chops or something in a song, and I would literally have to listen to the whole thing second by second, and all I would be waiting for is one tiny little sliver of something very specific. You know what I mean? Like a, maybe you're looking for like a flat two chord or like something that isn't the probability of it happening on somebody else's song might be very, very, very low.
Right.
But if you were able to play it, then you could do it immediately. There's no, you know what I mean? So it just got to a thing where I realized like I'm making this much more labor intensive than it needs to be. You know, when it got to the point where I wanted the source material to do these very specific things.
Right. How many records do you have to go through to find this exact chord change or whatever?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's and literally it start doing that. I mean, I would take home a box of 50 records hoping to do exactly this. And sometimes you'd get, you know, every now and then you'd get a Hail Mary. Most of the time you'd get something that's not really close, but you'd find something that's cool, but not what you wanted.
Yeah.
And then another 40% of the time you just completely came up dry. And that was the point at which I realized this just doesn't make sense. The smart thing here is for me to get myself to a situation where I can just play and record what I want exactly as I want it. And that became a very, very long thing because I had this really high standard of, you know, in terms of like texture and tonality and, you know, the sound of an instrument. You know, I was spoiled from using samples all day. So, you know, I kind of had a high bar to meet in that whole other field of engineering.
Right. Was that difficult to essentially try to recreate sounds that are now, you know, 40 years old and done, you know, in rooms you don't have access to and on, you know, equipment that is now outdated and basically impossible to find? Like, what was that like?
Yeah, it's very, very hard. And it's just to walk you through my trajectory as it relates to that. I initially set out to, my goal was, oh, well, I'll just buy the instruments, you know, if I'm, let's say, if whatever it is, acoustic piano or synthesizer or something like that, I'll just buy the exact synthesizer from this particular, that people were playing in 77 or 73 or 71 or whatever, you know, it'll take me a while, but I'll dig up that instrument and then I'll have that and then I can record that. And then that would apply to each thing. You know, I'd look at old amps and old guitars and blah, blah, blah. And it does become incredibly labor intensive. And at a point, there's also a thing. At the same time, following this path, you know, I started down that on the Since We Last Spoke tour. It was 2004 that was the first time that I really started getting real serious about trying to, my goal was to recreate that, you know, that the signal path of something that exactly as it would happen in, you know, from a record that I would sample. And I after doing that for years, I not only realized it was very difficult, and I shouldn't say that I gave up on it, but it's also, well, no, I gave up on it. But it's not because it was difficult. I gave up on it because along the way, I realized that there's kind of a fetishization that can happen around recreating old records. And that was a thing that I didn't really want to do. You know, I realized that it was counter to how I was, as a composer or you know, a guy who's making music, I never wanted to recreate something from the past. I was trying to do the exact opposite. I was trying to do something that had never been done before. I was trying to move. I had both feet very firmly planted in moving forward into the future. And when I realized that that was a possible, you know, distraction or detour that I could go down, that's at the point where I started. You know, I basically arrived where I am now, which is I have a lot of old gear, a lot of old mics. I have a lot of old instruments. I'm very into synthesizers. There's a very small handful of synthesizers that were made after 1984 that I like the sound of, you know? But at the same time, I'm not trying to go back and recreate The Secret Life of Plants.
Hello, flower. Or you look too stale. And you don't just, I'm coming to get. Right.
Or, you know, a Jean-Michel Jarre record or something. That I'm not trying to, you know, repeat the past. So now I'm just like, I have a bunch of stuff. I'm looking for good sounds that I like. They are very much informed by things that happened in the past, but I'm trying to move it forward, you know. So if something doesn't sound exact, Games You Can Win is a perfect example. I don't think the song sounds, it's got some old synths on it, it's got some old drums on it, and some old mics on it. But in terms of a general how I'm approaching the song, I'm just trying to be honest with, you know, it's not looking, the song isn't trying to be anything other than an honest portrayal of what I like.
It's funny you bring up that song because obviously that's with Kenna, and he's such a talented singer, and very strange circumstance in some way, in that like he knows everybody and does everything, but is not super famous in his own right yet.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a thing where we all navigate that intersection between, you know, being a quasi celebrity or whatever and making music. And it's a tough thing. You know, I feel in ways like people like Kenna have it, maybe not the worst, but they've definitely got it worse than I do. Guys like me, we never really had a shot at top 40-dom. You know, we were just nerds making beats and we still are, you know? So it's not, it was never on our, it is never in the realm of possibility. And because of that, we operate in a particular manner, you know. But for people like him, like he could have been, there's no reason he couldn't have been an Aloe Black or whatever. You know what I mean? He could easily be at the top of the charts. And I think that it can be difficult being in a scenario in which that is, having a lot of options can actually be a very paralyzing thing. You know, there's a beauty in limiting your options, you know?
Yeah. So the new record, the STS times RJD2, a lot of the songs in kind of the first half of the record have a very, you know, sort of soul music, very kind of Stax type feel.
Yo, get your hands in the air. You came to party tonight. We gon' get down, hell yeah. You have the time of your life. If you do it right. If you doing it right, hey girl, you bad as luck. Hey girl, I'm mad as fuck. That we ain't never fucked. I mean, like, what the fuck? Was that too abrasive for you?
Let me get that again. I got you back.
Well, goddamn, you hot as hell. I mean, I might as well see what that might entail. I got some slight tail from your homegirl. You know, I know your girlfriend's back in the day, and you know, she was telling me that you were looking for somebody, and so I'm slammed, but call me.
Why'd you decide to go in that direction for a lot of the tunes?
You know, it just kind of happened. It was a thing that was, there's a bunch of stuff that got cut from the record. You know, we recorded 22 songs making this record, and then we whittled it down to 12. And then you get later in the record, and there's tunes like Cruisin' or All I Wanted Was a Caddy or Fuck With That. And they're like, I don't think they have a whole lot to do with that sort of Southern Stax High Records type of soul feel.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it has to do with just the way that we sequenced the record. We whittled it down to 12 songs, and then we sequenced the record in a way that it was like, it just felt right.
Mm-hmm.
But I see what you're saying. There are some songs there that are very much drawing on kind of like a, and that's, you know, that Southern soul is like a, that music is in so many ways such an integral part of the DNA of hip hop. You know, so when I started, you know, I went from being a fan of rap.
Live from Bedford Stuyvesant, the livest one. Representing BK to the fullest. Gats a bullet. Bastards ducking when Big B bucking. Chicken heads be clucking in my bathroom fucking.
To being a fan of the guys who produce rap.
Stinky Smalls is the fullest.
To being a fan of the records that rap producers were sampling.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have the honey dresses in the house tonight. And they just got back from Washington, D.C. I think they got something they want to see.
And at that point, you know, just for the sake of them being sample fodder. And then at a point, I went from that to appreciating those records, the non-samplable parts of the catalog of those artists, just on their own merits as music. And that ended up informing what I do. It crept into my musical persona or whatever you want to call it, so much so that it's just it has become internalized now. So it's some of my favorite music, you know, Donny Hathaway, all the Stax stuff, you know, and we could go on and on, Willie Mitchell, blah, 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 blah. These are things that I discovered through hip-hop and then at a point fell in love with completely, you know, disassociated with hip-hop.
It's interesting because I feel like a lot of people, you know, in hip-hop are kind of coming back to that stuff in a big way. You know, Wu-Tang worked with a lot of the High Records band on their last album.
It's Wu-Tang, maybe my poop bang, and she's the preacher's daughter, I just call her my poop bang, and we're tired of this shoestring, or 10 grand in rubber bands, man, sometimes I tell your parents, just don't understand.
No.
You know, it's so, I don't know if it's something in the air or like, you know, that these various documentaries about these house bands are starting to get out there or whatever, but it seems to be like, you know, something in the air of that kind of sound coming back now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to me, a lot of it has to do with there's a complexity. Personally, my read on it is, you know, the chord changes of a song can dictate the feel of the song. For people like me, it basically does. That's what the song is, you know, about. If you don't understand the lyrics, you know, if you just remove any, you know, I've never seen music as a vessel to communicate a written word. You know, I've listened to so much instrumental music, so much jazz, so much ambient music and electronic music and blah, 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 that music that has no words, that, you know, what a song says through its chord changes and melodies and arrangement and feel and groove and all those things have a communicative element to them. And because of that, you know, there's a complexity there that you don't really... I don't want to pick on anybody. I'm not going to say, like, you know, a specific name or anything. But, you know, you turn on, like, quote-unquote top 40 urban rap radio right now. You know, like, what's the – and I'm not saying that it's – I'm not making a you know, a judgment call on it in terms of, you know, how much I like it or don't. Because some of the songs I really like. But let's just be honest here. Harmonically and melodically speaking, it's very, very, very simple music right now. It's very – extremely simple. You know what I mean? I feel like – it's in many ways what rap has done in the last 2 to 3 years. That type of rap, the you know, uber popular radio rap, has kind of been a race towards hyper minimalism. And I don't think that that's bad, because I mean, the Neptunes are one of my favorite groups of all time, and they perfected that.
From ghetto to ghetto, the backyard to yard, I sell it whip on whip, and soft to hard. I'm the neighborhood pusher, call me subwoofer, cause I pump bass like that, Jack, on or off the track. I'm heavy cuz, ball to your fathers, you can duck to the Fetty Gov, sorry my love.
You know, they were able to take that and do that at a time when it was radical and new. So I think that there's a time and place for it. But I think that when everyone... you know, jumps into that race to just hyper minimalism, then what you end up with is a scenario in which we're just at very, very basic keyboard, you know, bass lines, very simple melodies. You get the picture in the first one or two or four bars, and you don't really need to hear the rest of the song because it's not going to change. You know what I mean? There's no chord voicings that are, I'm not going to say they're none. Things creep through. You know what I mean? There's good music on the radio. I'm not saying that it's all bad. I'm just saying that by and large, that's where the trend, that's how things are seem to be trending. So that's why, you know, to answer the question of what, how I see this kind of fitting into the landscape or whatever, that's just how, you know, to me, that's what I would like to hear more of. So naturally, if I'm working on a rap record, that's where I'm going to go with it.
Sure. And how did you two end up, in what form did you end up collaborating? Because I feel like, you know, not only his raps not only match like the mood of your music, you know, song by song, but even within the songs themselves, how he's rapping and what he's rapping about will match, you know, change with kind of the mood of the music. Were you guys in a room together or mailing stuff back and forth? Like, how did a lot of that work? Because he was a Philly guy. I don't know where he lives now, but for a period, at least, he was a Philly guy, right?
Yeah. Ironically, we moved to the city right around the same time, right around 2002. We just didn't cross paths until much later. We started the record like most rap records start, which is, I mean, we knew each other, you know, we'd, you know, worked on things before this record. But mostly I was sending him tracks and he would listen through and then he would write, he would demo to stuff. And then once I would, and a lot of times he would demo to something without me even knowing it. He'd just like take it into this, cause he's a real spontaneous, you know, when, as far as how he writes, he gets an idea and he, boom, he's just going to go in and he's got to get it down. You know, he's like, and probably like a true, he's got a spirit for, and a passion for words almost unlike anybody that I've ever met. I mean, he's enamored with putting words together, you know, at its core poetry in a very similar way that I am with putting the building blocks of music together.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because on a couple songs on the record, his approach sounds even closer to spoken word than it does to rap.
He came out of that world, that's why.
Oh, okay.
He was a poet before he was a rapper.
Ah.
He was into spoken word poetry before he got real serious about rapping.
Okay. And whose idea was the Jay-Z cover?
Cover? Wait.
Fuck With That is sort of like...
A nod to... Yeah, it was his...
on his old, you know, pre-Reasonable Doubt song, I Can't Get With That.
So I hit him like this. Straight to the track, my lip is a fat, I rip it the fuck down. One in the fluke, I'm regularly wrecking this shit, so what now? With so many brothers biting, it's hard to detect to why. B, well, check out the J, check out the A, check out the Y. Z, river the fuck down. I'm more than a fluke. I'm regularly wrecking this joint. So what now? With so many niggas that's biting the style, I flipped it. Oh, gee. Now check out the ass. That nigga be fresh. Be dressing to the T. Original rap.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was his. It was his idea. You know, he wanted to do like a nod to that old, to that type of flow. But to answer your question, so the of how the record was made. So we would, you know, we'd send tracks back and forth. I'd send him a bunch of beats. He demoed them, and then I didn't even know if he wanted to use something because sometimes what I would send him would just be a 60-second blurb of something, an extremely crude sketch that was not intended to be used. I was just sending him stuff with the intent of him writing me back and saying, yeah, I like this, turn this into a beat. But he'd take it and he'd go into the studio and he'd loop up a section of it and he'd record a whole song to it, you know? So he'd demo it. And so then once he sent it back, it was like completely lopsided. There was this thing that, you know, my side of it would be uber demo, and his would be pretty well fleshed out as far as the song was concerned, you know?
Yeah.
So that's when I would kind of really build the thing up. You know, I'd take it apart and kind of start from scratch and just build the whole thing up. And then the beauty of it was that once he would send back the demo, it'd have an arrangement. You know, it'd have a verse, it'd have a chorus, it'd have an intro. And it was wild. It was pretty obvious what was what, but he would do it all over just a loop. You know, so in many ways, it made my job a lot easier because I could look at the different sections and say, oh, this should feel like this, or this should feel like that, or so on and so forth. And then I would do a bunch of recording, you know, build that thing up, send it back to him, and then he would usually recut the vocals. And on a bunch of tracks, we ended up, I would come and I would, you know, we'd do it in the studio together. And on some of them, we would do these like group vocal recordings, you know, we'd work out the vocal harmonies and we'd cut them. There was three of us that were kind of like, though the other two guys are better singers than I am. But, you know, we would do three-part harmony things live for some of the songs.
Wow. Who's doing, just real quick, who's doing the backup singing on 420? How you
feeling good? Yes, it do. Let it move through your soul. Let the herb take control of your mind and your body while we kick it like karate. Get higher!
That's Jordan Brown. So the three guys that were, you know, singing all the melodic lines on the record were, except for Dice Game, it was Jordan Brown, this kid Raj, and me. And Jordan and Raj have almost all of the identifiable lead lines. Jordan does the heavy lifting. He's on the first maybe four or five songs doing all of the chorus parts.
So I wanted to get into some of the kind of businessy stuff. Obviously, you know, your song A Beautiful Mind, or the instrumental version of it, is the theme to Mad Men. How do you feel now that the show is finally ending? Are you sort of watching, how are you feeling watching the last sort of half season of it?
You know, I mean, I feel, I guess there's kind of a lot to unpack there when I, you know, if I'm being honest with myself. You know, there's a part of me that's like, that experienced it as you know, doing that whole pathway of making an AC Lone record.
A beautiful mind turned water into wine, but that's not all. Broke the water, shined through, shaped the earth, created the code of life, radiated with energy, the great boat of life, the spark sparkling through the dark night, the walk that took forever without a thing in sight.
To make an instrumental version of it, to, you know, licensing the thing, basically doing, you know, the buyout thing for a TV show that hadn't aired yet and we didn't know anything about, to it becoming this, you know, behemoth that is culturally speaking, that is Mad Men. And then there's another part of me that just watches the show because I love the show and I'm a fan of good drama. So I'm not sad to see it end, in all honesty. And I love the show, but I feel like that's the natural trajectory of things. Shows like that. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like the lame way to go is to try to just milk a show like that into, you know, infinite number of seasons.
Right. Till they catch up with the present day or whatever.
Yeah, it doesn't really do service to the, you know, you look at great drama and you know, if we're talking about, it's like series drama, they almost always end, you know, The Wire, Deadwood, you know, I mean, Deadwood wasn't, as I understand, it wasn't intentional, but you know what I mean? Like, there, you can't just keep coming up with, you know, new storylines. I mean, the Game of Thrones is going to end. You know what I mean? And if it didn't end, then I think that we would all be a little less excited about it. So I think that it's kind of the perfect, you know, I think I'm really excited about where the show is at, and I love what they've done with it. I just think it's such a cool place for Don to come back to with this final season, you know, in terms of the social structure of the show.
And you mentioned in passing there the buyout, right? This is not a situation where you get, you know, royalties every time a show airs or whatever. It was kind of a flat fee up front, more or less?
Yeah. Yeah. They came, they wanted the publishing. So, you know, and they probably knew that it was, they probably knew they had a hit on their hands, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, that was how that was structured on the publishing side.
Do you regret not, did you negotiate to try and change that, or was it a take it or leave it? Do you regret maybe not pushing harder?
No, I don't. You know what I mean? You know, I see it as a thing that it was, I don't think that they would have done it. I think they would have probably used a different piece of music there if they hadn't done a buyout on it. So people, you know, people do ask me that. They're like, "Oh man, that's, you know," when I mention it, and I don't mean that as a slant. I mean I don't have any ill will or anything like that surrounding it. You know, it is what it is, as they say. It's one of those things where it's like, I don't think that it would have. I think they would have used a different piece of music if I had insisted to retain some of the publishing side. So there's no way to, you know, the way it happened is the only way that it could have.
Only way it could have happened, sure. And some of the other stuff you've done along those lines, I think things with like Wells Fargo and Saturn and stuff have been much more lucrative in the long term for you. How does the economics of something like that work? Like the Wells Fargo commercial, which used like a snippet of one of your songs.
Someday, being on top of your money. Today, open a Wells Fargo checking account and get unique tools that make managing your money easy. Seize your someday at Wells Fargo.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've never been opposed to licensing. You know, at the core of it, when it comes down to it, it's a thing that you don't... to me, as long as I'm not compromising with the making of a song, then I don't have any problem with where it's played, basically. And I kind of don't get it. You know, I mean, I shouldn't say that. It's not... I'm overstating that. There's things that I've turned down on moral grounds. You know, there's some things that I just don't want to be a part of.
Can I ask what?
I don't want to pick on anybody. Well, I guess the one is safe for me to say because I'm never going to do it. A tobacco ad. It's just a thing that I don't, you know, I'm not on a warpath about it, but it's just not a thing that I can't imagine a situation in which it would be worth there is no, how do you put a dollar figure on contributing to even one person becoming a lifelong smoker?
Right.
What is that dollar figure? You know what I mean? It's hard for me to imagine a scenario, you know, I'd have to have debtors up to my eyeballs banging down my door every day to even think about it, you know? So, you know, there's a handful of things that I have turned down, but as long as it's I feel like it's something that I'm, you know, I can, as long as I don't have a problem with it, you know what I mean? If it seems like a good fit, then I'm not opposed to licensing music. If anything, it's just a way to get what is, you know, for me, I see it as you know, kind of first and foremost, a way to get the weirdo type of music that I do a little bit more out there, a little bit more into the public consciousness or whatever.
Right. And especially since, you know, record sales being what they are these days, you know, it's often, I imagine, helps recoup the cost of making the stuff in the first place.
I could be wrong on this, but I have a suspicion that there is a bit of a, you know, a cultural unspoken agreement between music fans and artists now in 2015 that goes something along the lines of, we know that you're not selling any records, so we're not going to give you a hard time about, you know, the quote unquote sellout argument used to be a thing. You know, when I first started making records, that was a conversation that people had. And then, especially in rap music, you know, making money is such a dominant theme that, like, at a point it was like there was no, that fell by the wayside a long time ago.
Yeah. Do you score stuff ever, or is it always like pre-existing music that people will come to you about?
I've done some, you know, like what they call work for hire or scoring stuff. Not a whole lot of it, but I mean, I'm open to it, you know, and it's a thing that I actually have done a fair amount. It's hard. It's hard work, you know, and I like doing it. I like the challenge. But it's fundamentally different than making a song, you know, because you have to triangulate a bunch of different directions and wants within the music and stuff. And you also, there's also an issue of, there can be an issue of translation. You know, it's very easy for things to get lost in translation when you're discussing, you know, the nuts and bolts of music with anyone that's not knee deep in it.
Sure. And then you get the thing of like, okay, make it sound more blue or whatever.
For sure. And very simple things like tempo and pitch and key. The terms can get used interchangeably, you know, inadvertently.
Right. Change the key, meaning make it faster or something.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, more energy. It's like how, you know, there's a million ways that you can translate energy into actualization in terms of making a song.
Right.
You know, which one are we going to go for? You know, and I'm happy to dig into it because sometimes it's fun. And I've done some things that I never would have done through the process of, you know, some scoring things. And I like that challenge. That's how you grow. It's kind of like collaborating. You know what I mean? It's you. One of the things that I love about doing a collaborative record, such as the record with Slim, is that it will often push you into territories that you never would go on your own.
How do you find all this stuff? Is it, you know, do you have agencies or people at the, you know, at the companies or at the ad agencies, fans of yours, and approach you? Like, how does it vary? Yeah. Like, how does that generally work?
Yeah, you know, I got, you know, you build up relationships over the years, and you just, you know, I've found that over the years, the two biggest assets that I have found for being an artist is, number one, not being a jerk, and number two, just consistently, you know, not turning the lights off for too long. Just be somewhat, even mildly prolific. Just keep making records, you know, because oftentimes that's how people end up knowing that you're still alive and kicking, is that, you know, a record every 2 years or 3 years or whatever, a record will come out.
One or two more things, you know, kind of getting back to the music stuff.
Sure.
I thought that Insane Warrior project you did was so cool. Very like inspired by these like John Carpenter 70s, you know, Halloween soundtrack with the,
thanks,
you know, super crazy synths and stuff. What did you like about that era of soundtrack writing?
Well, I mean, you know, to use the Carpenter stuff as an example. One of the things that I love about that is that it's his music for those music movies came from the perspective of only a semi, and I don't mean this as an insult, because I think that it's really cool, but he wasn't a guy that was just a dedicated musician.
Right.
He just knew what worked against a picture, and I've always felt a kinship to people like that. When I first started being a DJ, I wasn't necessarily like, oh, DJs are musicians, because I always thought it was kind of just a boring argument to have. But people would very often want to enter into that argument on one side or the other. But my answer for that was always like, I don't really care if you want to call it being a musician or not. I just know how to get it done. You know what I mean? I know how to get from point A to point B. And that, I feel like, you know, John Carpenter, in regards to the music, was very much, you know, he knew how to get to point A to point B. And he also happened to fall at a time in which analog synthesizers were going through they were blossoming in ways. A lot of development happened technically in regards to synths between, you know, 1975 or 6 and 1985. You know, a lot of changes happened. And because he happened to be making movies at a time in that was happening, you know, he was able to take advantage of this. But, you know, to speak more broadly, there's just, I don't know, I mean, you look at, you know, the Blade Runner soundtrack, and it's just one of the you know, it's just a really gorgeous piece of music. You know, and it works great with the film. It's just a thing that I've always, I don't know, it's just always been into.
Got to get you to score a full feature film one of these days.
Man, I'd love to. If it was on that, yeah. I mean, really, any tip. But yeah, I would totally love to. I think that'd be really fun.
Yeah. And I couldn't let a chance to talk to you pass without asking about your work with Blueprint. Which is great, the couple records you've done with him. What makes your work with him stand out? Like, what is it about sort of how each of you works that it kind of sounds, it fits so right together?
Oh, man. Well, thank you. It's good to hear you say that. I don't know. You know, I guess, you know, if I think about it, I feel like we both have a pretty kind of, you know, attention to the meat and potatoes of a song approach to what we do. You know, he's the kind of guy that's always going to make a song about, well, I shouldn't say that every song is about, you know, any particular thing, but, you know, he puts thought into the ideas that are at the core of a song. I think that one of the first things that attracted to me, that made him appealing as a rapper to work with was that he was really good at enunciating. He was really good at, you know, he didn't have like any kind of mumbliness going on or anything. Like, he was really good at making you understand every syllable of every single word. You know, his delivery was very clear and concise and to the point.
One minute ahead of you, in the same hospital, maternity ward, crying in a crib, sitting right next to you. You got beef, I got vegetables, so if you really want it, you can leave with a full stomach.
And I think that there's, in many ways, I've tried to approach music in a similar fashion. You know, attention to what's really at the heart of a beat.
One sort of penultimate thing was the critical reception. I was curious about. You have like your first record, Dead Ringer, comes out. You know, critically, people love it. They're kind of falling over themselves. It's in some ways the very, you know, height of the sort of Def Jux movement.
Right.
It's held up, you know, as a sort of shining example of, you know, creativity in underground hip hop or whatever. And within a couple of years, The Third Hand comes out and some of the same outlets and some of the same people are just savaging it. And so rather than like, you know, the merits of either of the records, I was more curious about what it was like to go through that turnaround from where you were sitting.
It's been an interesting ride, you know. If I'm totally being honest, I think that this is probably the most interesting question or facet of my whole career personally. If I was ever asked to do a TED talk, I would talk about that. I would talk about 2007. I have thought on multiple occasions that I think that there is a lot to unpack there for something akin to a TED talk about risk. Because that was one of the biggest, in hindsight, I've always been fascinated with decision making. I feel like decision making is a thing that, it's very obviously it's the most. I feel like it's, you know, it's such an important part of everyone's life, and it's also such a not fully understood. It's a thing that I don't think that we put as much, examination introspection on, considering how critical of a role it plays in all of our lives. And I'm still learning and I'm still kind of unpacking the decision-making processes that led up to and through that record. But how was it for me? I mean, it was a ride, but I'm so thankful for it, really. You know, I'm first and foremost thankful for it because it gave me a reason to disconnect the social context in which records get made from the actual making of records. You know, it's very, very easy to get invested in the idea of being a critical darling, you know, and that was a real, I remember feeling incredibly burdened with that, really stressed, you know, dark, you know, mentally. Dark times right after that first record came out. only because you know that it's the first time that you're presented with dealing with something like that, and you can't downplay it. You can't take it lightly until you learn how to take it lightly. So, you know, going through that process of putting out that record and saying, you know what, I know that there's going to be some people that are going to be angry about it. I didn't realize how angry, and I didn't realize how many before I put that record out. But I had no idea, you know.
And so just for people who might not know it, this is a record where you wrote and sang, you know, kind of pop songs.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very fair description, but it's also a thing where, yeah, you could describe the exact same record in two radically different fashions. Here, I'll do it. One would be, here's a guy who made a bunch of hip-hop records, and he, you know, kept it very real, and he did this thing and carried the flag for, you know, sample-based music and underground hip-hop and rough, rugged beats and blah, 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 blah. And then he went and made this, you know, this candy-ass pop record. It was with a bunch of singing, and it sounded like, you know, it was just, you know, pillows flying through the sky, or I don't know, whatever, you know what I mean? And that's one way you could describe it. And then the other way that, you know, to me, the way that I saw the record was, I was always just a dude that was making beats. You know what I mean? That was my best foot forward, was, you know, making beats or whatever. And so The Third Hand to me was a record that was like, the production was the focal point. The instrumentals, the instrumentation, and the beats were all, that was the first thing that your ear would hear and listen to and catch. And the singing was maybe not a decoration, but it was, and maybe not an afterthought, but it wasn't the focal point of the songs. To me, when I made that record, when that record came out, that was exactly how I felt. And that was exactly how it made perfect sense to me. I was like, the vocalizations on this record are basically just another instrument. They're just another melodic device. They aren't the centerpiece. They're just a cog in the wheel. That's how I saw that record. And I didn't realize that, you know, and also it was a thing where it's like, I don't really care. You know, in an ironic way, the world that I came out of was one in which the only way that you could make a name for yourself was by challenging norms. So, you know, running with a pack, biting somebody else's style, sounding like somebody else, was a surefire way to not only not get noticed, but to kind of, you know, become a pariah, artistically speaking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That was like the one big no-no. You know what I mean? And so the way that you would get some attention was to do something different, do something nobody else was doing. So, you know, I guess there is an irony there that was a thing that I took to heart, to the point that I was like, okay, I'm willing to put this record out, not realizing that, yeah, there's a lot of people that they heard one record and they wanted you to do, they didn't want you to deviate, you know, aesthetically. And I agree. I do think that record deviates, but I just didn't realize to which degree people saw it as this just complete 180. You know, I saw it as something close to like a 330 degree turn, where I'm pretty close to back to where I was here, sort of, kind of, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
But
there was this narrative of like, oh, he left hip hop behind or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. 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 And it was there was that narrative. This was coupled with a thing where I was another thing that I learned that is totally, you know, unrelated to this, is that when you do, you know, press for records and you promote stuff, and you're talking about records, you end up doing a lot of interviews. All it takes is just, you know, one or two interviews for you to not speak, to speak less than eloquently, for you to look like. It's very easy to write. You know, that narrative was very easy to write. I'll just be honest. At that time. And part of it was that I just wasn't as careful with my words when it came time to interview and talk about things, you know. So I had this, like, you know, I had an experience where, somebody asked me about Dead Ringer. And, you know, at that time, I was thinking about The Third Hand as it relates to Dead Ringer and how, you know, texturally there's a lot more, it's just a more complex record, you know, and it's a little more highly polished record. It's a better mixed record. That record was, The Third Hand was mixed by a real engineer in a real studio, and there's a lot of, you know, sound elements on that record that were beyond what I had at my disposal on Dead Ringer. And that wasn't a qualitative judgment on either one. I was just pointing out what I thought was an engineering fact. You know, but saying that, it's very easy to interpret that as me saying that not only did I leave hip hop behind, but I thought that this record was aesthetically better than Dead Ringer, or aesthetically, you know, superior, or that I was downplaying the emotional or aesthetic content of my first record or my first two records or whatever.
And then there was an interview around that time where, in talking about sort of some of the difference between what you were doing now and your hip hop production, you know, I think it was for All Hip Hop or whatever, you used the phrase moron music in referring to your own hip hop beats, not like hip hop in general, but, you know, and in terms of like how easy it was for you to make them as opposed to the music you were making now and so forth. I think people kind of jumped on that.
In an interview with All Hip Hop in 2004, RJD2 was talking about the rap records he made immediately following his 2002 debut album. He said, quote, "All the shit I did was basically normal rap music, where I was doing this simple rap beat thing and it was fun and cool, 95 beats per minute, chop your shit up, whatever. Fucking moron music. I like it, but it's still moron music."
Precisely, and this is another example where it's like, you know, I can say something like moron music and people don't realize that I would be talking about, you know, just a very specific part of, and even then, not saying it very, it's a very ineloquent way of saying, of conveying an idea. But, you know, I wasn't saying that, that could be interpreted, if you just extract that as a soundbite, it can be, you can read it almost any way you want. You can read that as a judgment on the people that listen to the music. You can read it as a judgment on the people that make the music. There's a number of ways that it could be read, you know, and this was a thing that I just wasn't good at. I'm just being honest. I would go into interviews fundamentally under the assumption that myself and the interviewer were working towards an understanding of an idea. And that just wouldn't, you know, it never dawned on me that I would need to be guarded with how I talk and consider other ways in which either a narrative could be written or something could be interpreted.
I mean, that seems like a pretty intense experience to live through.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, again, it's a... In hindsight, it's a thing that I'm thankful for. I've been presented with some learning experiences that, you know, 0.00001% of the population are ever privy to, and I'm thankful for that. You know, this is a thing that you don't really learn to really choose your words until you're put in a situation where you don't choose your words very selectively or properly, you know. And ultimately, the other thing that, you know, another failing of mine was that I've always thought of interviews as a thing that are fundamentally play a supporting role or a lesser important role than the music. It never dawned on me that there would be an experience in which someone would read a blog before listening to a record. I was fundamentally under the impression that everyone would go listen to a record, like what they liked, not like what they didn't like, and that the you know, if they were to go out and read an interview or something, that it would be a a supporting role, if you will, towards the record. To kind of tie this whole thing up, you know, we talked a lot about how the difficulties of going through that process of the third hand or whatever. But the thing that I do think is important to bring up for me is that now, you know, it's 2015, I'm still making records, and I feel lucky to still be making records, but I particularly feel lucky because at this point in time, I'm happy with the context in which people will hopefully be perceiving the music that I'm, the records that I'm putting out. You know, I feel like at this point in time, it's doing that record in many ways kind of bought me the freedom to do something like The Insane Warrior, because it would have been at some point in time, there would be some reckoning period where I would have to say, you know, how close to the rule book am I going to play this? You know, and that was just a pretty flagrant.
You blew that out of the water a couple of years into your career.
Yeah. I just burned the rule book right then and there.
Right.
So now, you know, I have the freedom to, I'm not paralyzed by fear of, you know, what people might think about a record, you know, and I'm lucky. I feel extremely lucky that it didn't tank my career. You know, I'm still able to support myself doing this just enough that I can, you know, do what is my original intent, which was to, you know, make a body of work, contribute, hopefully create a catalog of music that is interesting and diverse and reflects my interests and loves in music, and isn't making the same record over and over.
And finally, you know, you were talking about words and how words are interpreted and so forth. And, you know, I know that a writer and historian you're a big fan of is someone I got to meet and interview years ago, Howard Zinn.
Oh, yeah.
What was it about his writing, his worldview that resonated with you?
You know, it was just a yeah, it's funny you bring that up. There is kind of a I think that there's a, it's probably apt talking about the third hand in that it was just a, you know, the People's History of the United States was one of the first books that I read that was really, you know, it was unforgiving in its point of view.
Howard Zinn was a historian, author, professor, playwright, and activist. His life's work focused on a wide range of issues, including race, class, war, and history. A People's History of the United States is his 1980 book that seeks to present American history through the eyes of the common people rather than political and economic elites. A People's History tells America's story from the point of view of, and in the words of, America's women, factory workers, African Americans, Native Americans, working poor, and immigrant laborers. Zinn, who passed away in 2010, was one of the most popular and influential historians, radical or otherwise, of his time. His work inspired artists like Episode 9 guest Talib Kweli, John Legend, Lupe Fiasco, Vinnie Paz, Bruce Springsteen, Pearl Jam, NOFX, and System of a Down. When Cypher Episode 26 guest Boots Riley of The Coup was asked to explain his political philosophy on Twitter, his immediate response was, start with Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States.
You know, and that coupled with a lot of, you know, there are other books that are, you know, important reads to me. But, you know, for my kid, that one's up there. When he's old enough, that's one that I would like him to read. You know, mostly just because it's honest and it's obviously counter to the narrative that most Americans have about our country. Yeah, I don't know if there's anything else to say about it really than that.
Did you ever get a chance to hear him speak or meet him while he was alive?
No, I did not. Did you enjoy your interview with him?
Yeah. I'd met him in person once, and then the interview was over the phone. And yeah, he was always, always great. So, all right. Well, good luck in your show in New York City tonight. I know the live thing has always been huge for you, although you're not doing the same touring, you know, rigorous touring that you were at one point. But the new STS times RJD2, a really, really awesome record, and congratulations on it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time.
So as you heard in the beginning, I always loved passing through Columbus, Ohio in my indie rock touring days. I have fond memories of Bernie's Bagels, the place we talk about in the beginning that somehow always managed to smell like a bathroom, no matter where in the place you were. It was cool to hear about RJ's own Columbus experiences.
and his time in San Francisco, the stuff that led him eventually to the great record he made with Def Jux. I, and especially my producer Josh, really liked hearing about his obsession with vintage gear from the 70s, how deep that obsession got, and how he managed to get out of it. Hearing his take on sampling, something that's been kind of a theme over the past several shows, and how he transitioned into playing instruments on many of his records, was very interesting as well. And if there are any artists out there who have ever dealt with bad reviews, well, you've got company. I also enjoyed hearing a bit about the business behind the Mad Men theme and some of his other adventures in the corporate world. Next week, we have a bit of an unusual guest on our show, punk rock legend John Lydon, aka Johnny Rotten. He has a new memoir out called Anger is an Energy. We talked to him about that, and because it is the cipher, his work with hip-hop icon Afrika Bambaataa. So join us next week to hear the original prophet of No Future and one of the inventors of punk rock. You can find The Cypher on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. You can also find a playlist of the songs heard on this episode and all of our past shows online at thecyphershow.com. And again, don't forget to visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and subscribe on iTunes. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
The only way that you could make a name for yourself was by challenging norms.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
And I love the show, but I feel like that's the natural trajectory of things.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
They're just another melodic device.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher. What is this, episode 105?
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome to The Cypher. I'm your host,
Fuck, fuck, fuck. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Fuck, fuck, fuck.